My name is Cathy Darcy. I'm a writer and a youth worker based in Cork in Ireland. And I'm over here for the past 2 weeks doing readings, poetry readings and workshops. I have two collections. My first collection, Encounter, is published by Lapwing Press, which is a Belfast press. And my second book, The Wild People, is published by Bradshaw, which was an excellent feminist Cork press. They've since gone out of business, unfortunately, but they were fantastic.
Okay, part of what we'll do today is we'll spend a little bit of time talking about your writing. We also want to hear about the women's rights work that you're doing in Ireland. From talking with you, it sounds like there's a lot of parallel issues that we're experiencing. So I wanted to start off kind of there. Talk about what you do for your day job, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, so I'm a teen parent support worker, which is a silly name now. I don't think young people like that name anymore. So I support young parents, young mothers and fathers, through pregnancy and I suppose everything that they need support-wise around learning to be parents. So a lot of what I do now at the moment is focused on accommodation because we have a huge homelessness problem in Ireland. I will also do like independent living skills, budgeting, advocacy with professionals like legal services, medical services, parenting skills, emotional support, support with family members, whatever people need. So it's a very nice kind of service.
So simultaneously, as you do this, you support parents and you also have been fighting for reproductive justice in Ireland. Talk about the social landscape as it pertains to reproductive justice in Ireland and some of the hurdles and obstacles you've experienced in that realm as well.
One of the things I've been doing while I've been over here is trying to spread the word about this and kind of garner some solidarity. So Ireland has this Eighth Amendment to our constitution, which was put in 1983, which equates the life of a woman to the life of a fetus, which means that we can't have any abortion services really at all. So women have to travel to England to have abortions, which obviously is very pressurizing for women and obviously something that not everyone can afford to do or is able resource wise to do. We recently got a protection of life bill, which was supposed to soften this amendment somewhat, but actually all it did was impose a 14-year prison sentence on anybody who seeks a medical abortion by ordering pills online over the internet, which of course are widely available legally in almost every other country in the developed world.
And I'm going to pause you there just so you could elaborate on that a little bit.
So in the early 90s, we had what was called the X case. This was a case where a young woman had been raped and became pregnant and became suicidal because she needed a termination. And the Irish government intervened to prevent her from travelling to England for a termination. That case was taken further into Europe and eventually she was granted the right to travel. And since that time then, several other very brave women have taken their cases to the European Court of Human Rights and the UN against Ireland, saying that Ireland is torturing them, which it is, in my view. And the UN has found in their favour on every occasion, really. Well, on almost every occasion. But the government has ignored the outcomes of those cases. So then in 2013, we got this Protection of Life Bill, which was supposed to be an answer to some of these cases. But in fact, all it did was allow for abortion in the case of suicidality. But if you break that down, suicidality means that a panel of obstetricians and psychiatrists have to deem you suicidal enough. And it has recently come to light that most of the time, these women are not deemed suicidal enough and are denied termination. And the other thing that that bill brought in was this 14-year prison sentence for accessing a medical abortion online.
And I understand from talking with you that today, October 2017, there was a major piece decided on in terms of looking at repealing the Eighth Amendment.
I could go on for so long about this, so I'm going to try and be as brief as possible. The government has been trying to push this down the line forever, because they just don't care about women, in my view. So they had this thing called a Citizens' Assembly this year, which was a group of 99 random citizens were going to debate whether or not we should have a referendum. They came out overwhelmingly in favour of choice, overwhelmingly. So the government then, that kind of wasn't good enough for the government. It wasn't the answer they wanted to hear. So they set up this joint parliamentary committee, which was going to debate the results of the Citizens' Assembly. You can imagine how frustrating all this is. So they are currently in the process of debating this. Meanwhile, the second largest party in Ireland, the party that's not in power right now, but is generally in power, Fianna Fáil, had their party conference, it looks like today, and they voted on whether or not to repeal the Eighth Amendment, and overwhelmingly they voted against repealing the Eighth Amendment. So I've just discovered that today, that's just happened. So this second largest party in Ireland are overwhelmingly against what has turned out to be the vast majority of the Irish people in regard to fighting for choice and women's rights.
And I think that this is an interesting thing that our American audience would be interested in hearing about. It sounds like a fair amount of the funding for some of the anti-choice groups in Ireland is actually coming from the United States. Can you talk about that for us?
Yeah, so that's what it looks like to us. To us, it seems that American right-wing pressure groups are funneling millions of dollars into what we call the anti-choice campaign. So we get a lot of American groups coming over to Ireland, having very high-profile talks, conferences. They plaster the city with very distressing posters that traumatise and stigmatise women who are considering termination or have chosen termination. They fund the Irish anti-choice movement. It seems to me that they're interfering in the democratic process, and also kind of distressingly that they think that Ireland is some kind of plaything, that they can decide how women are and how women behave and what women can and can't do with their bodies from America, which is infuriating to me. And I suppose I really want to spread the word about that here and just, as I say, gather some solidarity from pro-choice Americans that this is happening in Ireland.
And that might be a really good point to spread solidarity, or a place where people might be able to empathize a lot. As you know, here in the United States, President Donald Trump has put forth something for religious freedom that will let companies opt in or out of providing reproductive health care coverage for American women. What's your take on that, and how does it parallel what you're experiencing?
Yeah, it's terrifying to me. You know, I was talking to some Californians about this because I think of California as a very progressive state, and it is. So we would aspire in Ireland towards the kind of reproductive rights that are available to most people in America. I know that, of course, there are still boundaries of class and culture and resources, as we have in Ireland, but you do have Planned Parenthood and you do have places where women can actually access abortion. So to see those rights being rolled back as they are being by the Trump administration is very distressing for us. It feels like all of the fighting that we're doing and all the fighting that's been happening here for years is starting to be overturned and eroded. And I feel like it's kind of the responsibility of everyone who's pro-choice to fight against that, like, and to make their voices heard. I think that's what's happening.
And so in the United States, one of the points of frustration for many is that there's a lot of people fighting against reproductive rights and taking a very anti-choice stance. So then you would think if they're going to cut funding and resources in this area, then surely they're going to provide help for these women and care with their like extra resources for care. And that's not the case. And I'm similar. How does that compare with Ireland?
Yeah, so actually to say, first of all, there's no free contraception in Ireland. We have to pay for our contraception. We had a recent recession, as you guys did. And during that recession, one of the things that was cut and kind of very severely cut was childcare and support for single parents, that kind of thing. So it became much more difficult for single parents to get by. Now that we're having what appears to be a kind of resurgence, a worryingly kind of quick recovery, Some of those facilities are coming back online. So there's some, we have made some improvements in childcare, but they're really only still climbing towards what might be an acceptable level of support. Still, to be a single parent in Ireland is incredibly difficult. So as you say, it's incredibly hypocritical for right-wing people to talk about being anti-choice while at the same time providing absolutely zero support for people who do choose to continue pregnancies and then are trying to raise children in difficult circumstances.
And so the last piece on this before we shift a little bit and talk about your writing and how you kind of move these issues forward in that, sometimes people from the anti-choice movement might not assume that somebody who is really active in the pro-choice movement would be really invested in working with young parents and people who are opting into having a child. So talk about the duality of that and the complexity of it and why it really fits together in your view.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been working with young people for a long time in kind of all aspects of their lives. And this is, I think I've found my niche. I think working with young parents is an incredible privilege, and they're incredibly impressive people. But to me, supporting young parents and young people is also like supporting the reproductive rights of those people is a part of that. And I don't know if it's the case in America, I'm sure it is, but in Ireland and the UK, statistically, the majority of women who choose termination are already mothers. So supporting mothers and supporting access to reproductive rights and reproductive healthcare, they go hand in hand. I currently am very curtailed in what I can and can't do around that in my job in Ireland because of the laws. And I think that's disgusting. I think I'm not doing my job as a healthcare worker if I'm not offering women and pregnant people the full suite of reproductive options so they can make the right choices for themselves.
Great. And now to transition a little bit to your writing, or to look at yet another dimension of your work, talk about the role that writing has had for you and how you've been able to use that as a platform to really take on these types of issues. And then, of course, I'll ask you to read a piece for us as well. But
yeah, so actually it's been a journey for me. I was very scared to write political poetry. It's not seen as proper poetry to a lot of people in Ireland. So it's been a journey of kind of rebellion and turning away from the status quo.
And for you, you became a doctor.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So, I mean, I didn't come from the kind of family where you could say I want to be a poet. So I was very interested, and I still am, in human anatomy and physiology and how bodies work. So I was able to train to become a doctor, which was great. But I disagree with the way that Western medicine treats people. I feel like pharmaceutical industries have too great a say and too much power in how healthcare is provided to people. And even we do have, you know, we have a more robust healthcare system for disadvantaged people than America does. But it's still got a huge amount of cracks and gaps and holes, and people are still being patronized and kept just slightly unwell by our system. So I didn't want to continue in that system. I felt I was better being outside the system, being an advocate for people with their healthcare issues.
Which brings you to poetry. So talk about that and your political writing. And sorry, I had to include that tangent because it's just okay. Such an important piece in the story.
Yeah, I forget myself. But what happened for me was that I couldn't stop writing politically. Like, I couldn't keep not doing it. I just became very angry. And I think it's quite funny. Like, I've been over here with several other Irish poets who haven't, like, we'll say they're men. And, you know, I don't want to be mean, but they haven't experienced, I suppose, oppression in the same way as we'll say I have with my body in Ireland. So when we were talking about political poetry, they were saying things like, I don't know what my poetry could say about it, which is such a silly thing to say, because poetry is of its nature political and has begun in a political place and will always be political. But aside altogether from that, I can't write about anything else. I don't know if you guys know about De Valera. He was our first leader, and he was incredibly entwined with the Catholic Church. And therefore, our constitution is very full of kind of very restrictive Catholic ideologies. So I often introduce my poetry these days by saying that, you know, I wish I could write about other things, but until I can prize De Valera's cold, dead hands off my uterus, I'm actually going to have to keep writing about this topic.
And with that, why don't you choose a piece and read it for us, and then I'll have you talk to us about it afterwards.
Okay, this is quite a controversial piece. Is that okay?
That is.
It is called, I wrote it just before I came here, and I'm so happy to be able to read it to an audience.
Thank you for sharing with us first.
It's called To the American Pressure Groups Funneling Millions into the Irish Anti-Choice Campaign. It's a letter. Dear sirs, I know it must be lovely to have your leprechaun land like a dream in the back of your mind as you live your choice-filled life. A land where girls dance at crossroads, girls who are always virgins. Where we all wait with bated breath on our knees for you to say how you want us to be. But I'm real. I'm not your puppet. I'm a real person with hopes and dreams. I want to be safe. I want to be free. I built this life from the ground, and it belongs to me, and my body belongs to me, and its pleasure is mine, not yours, because we are not incubators, and we won't be breeding more leprechauns for your factory farm, and we won't be used as machines to churn out more bullshit Irish dreams. And I wish my father's mother, a girl who wanted to learn, didn't have to bear 18 children, 15 who lived, for a drinker 20 years older than her who couldn't remember their names. I wish we didn't have unmarked mass graves under housing estates where there used to be church-run mother and baby homes. I wish any rape case ever in this leprechaun country could end in conviction. It's true that we all have saints' names here, but we won't be martyred again. We have choices. They are ours to make, and we make them well. They are not yours to take away. We're real. So take your lies and your dollars and leave us alone.
Wow, that is amazing. And did you write that today?
I wrote it on the way here.
Fantastic.
It just felt important to do that.
And I think you've given us a little bit of a glimpse of why this is important. But anything more you want to say about this piece?
Not really, just I think I've said everything I needed to say in the poem, but I'm so happy to have the chance to talk to a wider audience today about solidarity between women in different countries. And I think, you know, our leaders are not making the right choices. They're not making good choices for us. And it's important for us to stay together and to support each other and to make contact with each other from country to country throughout the world and to keep supporting each other in our fights for our rights.
Did you want to read one more poem for us?
Oh, yeah. OK. Will I read like a less angry poem?
OK.
In the order of things, this probably should have gone first.
It's OK.
So I'm doing a creative writing PhD in UCC, and the text is very much about women. And what I'm doing, because I think that language is very patriarchal and language traps and oppresses us. So I've taken a lot of different texts and I'm kind of mashing them together and chopping them up to try to say something that they're not saying. So this poem is a collage of fragments from the book The Golden Bough by James G. Fraser. And all I've done is change the word bear to the word woman. And it's called Sacrifice. On the one hand, they give her the name of Kamui, or God. In bygone years, the most manly and useful autumn, winter and spring in hunting. The other hand, kill her whenever the woman, the tribute, the taxes are paid in skin. Subsist on the meat, the flesh, the staple. They eat both fresh and salted. The skin of the woman is turned to cloth. In fact, the worship they speak of is paid chiefly to the dead woman. Thus, although they kill her whenever they can, they admire her, worship her, offer it presents. The skull of the woman is set outside, but they do not call themselves women. In the pride of their heart they say, and even if that were so, it would not explain, and it is the feast that concerns us here. At the end of winter, a woman is caught, at first, and when it grows big enough to wound, by hugging or scratching 2 to 3 years, but not just to furnish a meal, rather have treated her kindly as long as can feed her no longer, are obliged, apologise, give the feast, community, somewhat as follows. I, so and so, come ye to the feast. We will unite, a great pleasure, come. Mr. Bachelor heard. Then having been secured with ropes, has spent itself in vain struggles, tied to a stake, is gagged and strangled, but not so as to shed blood, which would be unlucky. However, they sometimes drink. The courage and other virtues pass into them. Every scrap except the bones must be eaten. The back of the woman becomes the table. Until nothing but the bare white skull is left. They really do believe Mr. Bachelor, who witnessed on August 10th a bowl immediately upset. And they danced and sang a monotonous song. She is led about. She is taken before. A stick placed in her mouth in 5 minutes without a sound. Is placed on the mat, are hung about her neck, is severed from the trunk. The blood of the woman is caught in cups. The blood of the woman is eagerly swallowed. The liver of the woman is cut in pieces with salt. The flesh of the woman is kept. The woman is offered to Mr. Bachelor. Those who had been merry a moment before, the brain of the woman is eaten with salt. When they find a young woman, an antidote to poison, the heart of the woman is good for nothing. We are told that they do not look on the woman as a god. To this discourse, the woman listens without conviction. The mouth of the woman is offered a repast. The flesh of the woman is offered to her mouth. The mouth of the woman is kept as a sacred thing. Must not enter the house through the door. Is let down through the smoke hole. The use of salt and pepper. No morsel may be given to the dogs. The head of the woman is carried into the forest. A heap of skulls. Some prostrate themselves. Is eaten in special vessels, is boiled by the oldest man. The entrails of the woman are eaten last. The legs of the woman are laid on the ground as if to ask her leave. The fat of the woman is laid on the ground before her that she might be first to taste. Is wiped clean of tears, is carried away. A broth is obtained. The skull of the woman is wedged in the cleft of a tree. Its soul carries off the souls of these things, milk, honey. The jawbone of the woman is hung from a tree. The jawbone of the woman is a charm against evil. The woman is hung from a tree. There are features which can hardly be distinguished from worship. Certainly they appear to apply the name for God freely, just as at the killing of a housewoman. The people have reasons, and some very practical, for acting as they do, and yet single out certain women for homage, deification. We must not hastily set them down, our own views of the world. Be not afraid. We will not hurt you. You were sent into the world for us to hunt. We have done enough for you. Remember, remember. It is now for you to do your duty.
Got to take a breath after that one. It's really powerful. And you said your main artistic choice for that was to replace the word bear with woman.
Yeah. And unless I had told you that, I don't think you'd have known.
Right. And so talk about why you chose this piece and that technique for this and the message you hope to send by it.
So as part of my PhD, I've had to read a lot of these books that are seen as Bibles, like Yeats, for example, a man who was incredibly sexist, like many of the Irish male poets. Would have loved the Golden Bough and would have spoken very highly of it. But the Golden Bough is a very patriarchal, very patronising text where Fraser seeks to gather all of the mythologies of the world to say something about him and about his society. So I wanted to take that apart a little bit. And as I was reading it, and so this text comes from multiple descriptions of how bears would have been sacrificed, I thought, it's very easy to put the word woman in here. If I put the word woman in here, everybody will think that that's what happened, because this is the way that women have been treated. And this is the way that women are treated. Women are routinely sacrificed. Women's rights are sacrificed. Women's bodies are sacrificed. Women's bodies are seen as meat, as objects, as commodities. And so it was a very neat substitution for me. And as I said, mashing this up and cutting it up, it said what I wanted to say. So the collage actually speaks for me now. It says something that I wanted to say that I don't think I could have said without it.
That's amazing and a brilliant technique. And that leads me kind of to the next section of questions that I have for you. I had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time with you today and share a meal and a chai and exchange stories. And you seem like a person of great balance, and yet you take on some really difficult, controversial topics that can be life-sucking in some instances. So talk about your own kind of creative process and what you do to really stay centered and balanced.
Okay, so it has been a journey, as I said, and I take on these topics not because I choose to, but because I have to, because they're right up there in my face, interfering with how I live my life and how the people around me are living their lives. But I walk a lot is something I was discussing with you earlier. I walk as part of my writing practice. Walking is central to my writing practice, and the idea of the journey and the idea of the pilgrimage and the idea that if I walk on a path where maybe thousands of other people have walked with good intentions, I will somehow be a part of that energy. I suppose it's a kind of metaphor, I suppose, for wanting to be part of a greater positive energy. Now, I'm not religious at all, but I believe in intention. And for me, the process of walking ancient paths and making pilgrimage in whatever way that that is, brings me to that place of positive energy and is a very grounding thing for me. So in my teaching practice, I routinely take students on writing walks.
When you're talking about walking, you go to great distances to go for a walk. Sometimes it might be in Nepal. Now it will be at Lake Merritt. Talk about some of the destinations you've gone to do this.
Yeah, so the first really long walk I did was the Camino de Santiago, which is across the top of northern Spain. It's 1,000 kilometres. And it's very easy, and I would recommend everyone to do it because it's very well guided and well structured. But it's a very beautiful experience to just pack your bag every morning and just walk on, and then stop when you feel like it, stop when it's dark, and then get up the following day and do the same thing. So I've also walked in Nepal in the Himalayas. I walked to base camp, and as I was saying to you earlier, there's a part of me that feels the need to push myself into very extreme physical situations, because there's a purity that comes from that. It's not about self-flagellation. It's about casting off shells or facades that I might have built up around myself, and getting to a place of greater purity. And it certainly, I find that it works for me. Then I've explored some pilgrimage paths in Ireland, one in particular that goes from Ardmore on the kind of southern coast up to the Rock of Cashel, which people might know. It's kind of very central, I suppose, religious and prehistoric area in Ireland. It's something to do with getting away and escaping and the kind of meditative quality of just putting one foot in front of the other. It's a quality I want to have in the rest of my life. So I try to capture that in my walking.
And what's occurring to me right now is another level of duality, right? One of the things you said about walking is that it's amazing to walk on this path that thousands of people have walked on before you. And then on another hand, you've really created your own path through life, kind of broken some of the conventional rules around marriage or around what you were supposed to do for a career. Would you want to reflect and share anything about that process for you?
Yeah, actually, the reason I started teaching creative writing was because of my own early experiences where I started to write poetry when I was a child. And my parents, you know, it isn't that, well, they were kind of unsupportive because they felt it was very important for me to get a normal job and be, you know, a normal person with a normal job. So, and that's how come I ended up being a doctor. And so when I left medicine, as you can imagine, my teachers, my friends, my parents, my family, strangers were appalled and outraged and fearful for me. But I was fine because I was following my passion and I'm still fine. I'm really happy. And that's why I started teaching. So I teach everybody. I teach very young children. I teach very elderly people, specifically to pass on that message that you just need to follow your heart. You don't need to do things that you don't want to do for fear that you won't be okay. If you follow your heart and follow your passions, that you will be okay. And that's very important for me to spread that message, especially to young children.
And another thing we were talking about along with this is sometimes people feel like within the constraints of a relationship or within the context of a relationship, depending on the type of relationship it is, I suppose, sometimes people might really stray away from what their heart is speaking because they're trying to follow what they presume that they need to do in order to stay in a particular relationship.
I suppose that's something I see a lot in my work because I work with a lot of young mothers, many of whom have made, you know, the wrong relationship choices, and I can't blame them for that because that comes from our culture, where, you know, we were talking earlier about the Catholic Church and how, like, I was raised very Catholic, and that would be the case for the majority of people in Ireland, of my generation, maybe less so now, and how poorly that kind of upbringing prepares you to make the right decisions and to make relationship choices for yourself and for your well-being, as opposed to, as you said, for reasons of conformity or safety or security or fear. And I think a lot of people, you know, unfortunately, are still making those relationship choices, which is our legacy, I suppose, in Ireland, and something I'm still working to, and we all are working to overcome. But it's so funny, like, so I'm 38. I don't want to have any children. I haven't had any children. And I'm not sure if it's the case here on the West Coast, but in Ireland, that's not all right. And never, like, as I enter my late 30s, there's less pressure because people are starting to give up on me. But in my early 30s and my late 20s, the pressure was enormous. And I don't think a day went by when I wasn't asked by a stranger, again, in the vast majority of the situation, would I have children? And why wouldn't I have children, as though it was anybody's business except my own, or as though I didn't have a choice in the matter. So I found that infuriating. I really am. I'm the first generation in my family who can actually make this choice, which is incredible to think. Like, contraception only became legal in Ireland in the 70s, in the late 70s. And I'm very proud and grateful to be able to make this choice. And there's a part of me that's making it for my grandmothers, who I referenced in that first poem, who didn't, well, this one grandmother in particular did not want to have children. She wanted to be a scholar and ended up having 15 children.
And that wasn't an option for her to be a scholar. 15 children.
No, she was essentially sold to her husband. Yeah, yeah. And that was very much the norm for those women. So there's a part of me that feels a duty to those women who I'm alive because of, to live my life freely. To be liberated, to be as liberated as I can be, and to make the choices that are right for me.
I wondered if you'd be willing to talk about how you've navigated these issues within the context of your own relationship.
You know, I'm extremely lucky because my partner also doesn't want children. So again, when we say that to people, people have all sorts of, they're always negative reactions. But I have had, you know, I've obviously been in previous relationships with people who did want children. And looking back on those relationships, I would have had children for those people, and I say the word for deliberately, because I suppose the country I was in and the culture that I came from, I wouldn't have had the strength to be like, no, you know, no, my choice is to not have children. So I'm really lucky that those relationships didn't work out. And I do feel really lucky and grateful that I'm in a relationship where there's no pressure to have children, though I do worry all the time, and I do say to my partner all the time, you know, at some point you're going to have the menopause and you're going to, you know, leave me for a 21-year-old and have 8 children with her. And you know what? If that's his decision, that's fine, because I'm not going to have any 8 children for anybody.
Right, so you're still staying true to yourself regardless, yes. Which yeah. I think is a really big thing that women around the world could really learn from and really knowing what's going to work for you.
Well, it's lucky for me because I have those resources. Do you know what I mean? I'm not being forced to marry somebody. I can leave if I want. I have the economic resources to leave. There's so many women who aren't in that situation still today who are in basically my grandmother's situation. I feel that a lot. It's something I think about a lot.
Yeah, and we've covered a great deal of territory. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I suppose the most important thing for me at the moment is women's rights and reproductive health care. And I just think, you know, if you're listening and you're not currently involved in defending reproductive health care, it's something you can do. I know from the research that I've done that California is really good for that. And there are tons of brilliant organizations. You can contact your local Planned Parenthood. You can volunteer. You can donate. You can even just speak out on social media. There's so many ways that you can show the government that actually you are in favor of women being able to choose for themselves. And I suppose that's what I'd like to say. Just as I constantly say to people in Ireland, just keep speaking out, keep showing your support.
And of course, I would be remiss not to provide a little bit of space for you to share the titles of your books and also the way that our listeners could find them if they wanted to explore some more of your work.
Sure. So my first book, Encounter, is available through the Lapwing Press website, which I'm pretty sure is lapwingpress.com. But that information is on my website, which is kathydarcy.com. That's Kathy with a K. And the other book, The Wild Pupil, is available also on my website. So if you go to my website, kathydarcy.com, you'll find links to how to buy both of those books.
Okay, Kathy Darcy, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.